counsel. Okay.
Right. Got to wait for the videos.
We need to wait just a moment till the justices can get into the other conference room in the Las Vegas courthouse. Justice Perry-Gary, can you hear me from Carson City? Okay. And Justice Stiglich, are you on?
I am, Chief.
Thank you. I'll call the next case then, Romano versus Romano, case number 81259, clustered with 81439. As counsel can see, Justice Kadish and I are in Carson City. Associate Chief Justice Perry-Gary, Justice Silver, Justice Pickering, and Justice Herndon are located in Las Vegas in the Las Vegas conference room downstairs. We have a connectivity challenge apparently in the courtroom in Las Vegas. And Justice Stiglich is participating by phone. Ms. Hughes, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Chief Justice.
Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices. I am Rena Hughes for the appellant, Aaron Romano, who's also present. I'll make my presentation brief and to the point. The original case in the district court involved two critical errors. In addition, your order required further briefing on six questions, which I will answer. However, turning to the district court errors, the most important one was actual the joint physical custody arrangement did not exist at the time the court summarily denied my client's motion. When a parent has no contact with a child for over a year, you cannot possibly call this joint physical custody. And in this case, that happened with at least three of the children. The next critical error by the district court was a support and fee order that stemmed directly from that impossible custody order and likewise requires reversal. Turning to the court's six questions, whether or not modification of joint physical custody requires both a change in circumstances and a best interest finding under Ellis. The answer is yes, but how to do so is dependent on the circumstances. On one hand, you can have a situation as we do here where both parents agreed to a de facto change in the actual custodial order, then it should be presumed correct, and the district court should find that they are doing what's in the best interest of their children. After all, they are the parents, and they are free to contract in any way that is not illegal, unethical, or violates public policy. Conversely, if the parents are not in agreement and there's a de facto change in the custodial schedule, the court can still determine what's in the best interest of the child. But that ties in with the court's question about revisiting Rivero. Because in every case, whether it's joint physical custody or primary physical custody, the actual custodial schedule being followed since the entry of the last order will have to be determined, whether it was agreed upon or imposed by one parent on the other. And of course, a de facto change does not require just some flexibility that parents do on a day-to-day basis to help their children go to school or extracurricular activities. It requires a deviation from the written order. But a comparison of the actual terms of the custodial order and what the parents are actually doing is really all that is required. Contrary to what my opponent has suggested, it does not require delving into the subjective intent of parties who have contracted to follow a certain custodial schedule. Looking beyond that violates the parole evidence rule. And we know that parole evidence doesn't come in unless there's an ambiguity or it lacks specificity in some way. But when you look at this parenting plan, it did not lack specificity and there was no ambiguity. Following this determination and this analysis is consistent with the legislative directive that any change in custody be based on the best interests of the children, and it also allows parties to uphold their contracts. As to the court's third question on whether or not the steps to change to determine a change in circumstances is not upon mutual agreement, that analysis is very simple. The district court can simply look at the last custodial order, what the parents are doing, whether or not one parent coerced the other one into changing it, whether they're in agreement or not. And then Rooney will require whether or not an evidentiary hearing happens. The district court has to assess whether the moving party has met a prima facie showing under Rooney. But I submit when the district court makes those findings, it should be specific under Rooney. Why is it granting an evidentiary hearing, or why is it denying an evidentiary hearing? That should all be stated on the record. But again, there should be a single standard for all modifications of a change in custody, because otherwise we're going to get differing orders from the district court. They are focused on what label they have to determine and when they have to determine that label. For example, does the district court apply the label from the last custodial order, or does the district court apply the label from the de facto change? It can cause confusion at the district court level. If we have the same standard, the district court can focus on the standard and the individual facts and circumstances of every case. From a parent's perspective, written orders mean one thing to the court, but something else to a family. And whether it's 38% or 42%, the same standard should apply. Parents are involved in the business of life and raising their children and should have that expectation from the court that one standard applies.
Ms. Hughes?
Yes.
Sorry, Ms. Hughes, if I may. If the parents are free to make a contract about how they're going to handle this, and in doing so may engage in fictions, may agree on words that help them come to an agreement, why shouldn't the court respect that agreement? To hold otherwise, if the labels don't exactly match what the parents are agreeing to, but the labels are important to the parents, then you get in that situation where then the court would never be respecting these agreements that come out from the parents. It could be a week later somebody could turn around and say, hey, I know we have this agreement, but it means something different than we said. So why shouldn't the court, why is it too much to ask the court to find and determine whether there have been changed circumstances before it kind of peels back, you know, starts peeling the onion, essentially?
Well, again, parents are free to contract, and they should put the terms specifically in their contract. And the court should uphold that contract. So looking beyond the words of the language of the four corners of the documents requires parole evidence, and that's well established. We don't look at parole evidence. They should put in the contract what exactly they mean and why they mean it. And it's res judicata. If there's no change in circumstances from their order, from what they put down in writing, if there's no change in circumstances, res judicata applies and the analysis doesn't go anywhere.
So, Ms. Hughes, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. So, in this case, the parties worked out a lengthy, detailed custody arrangement with different shares, different schedules for the different children who have widely disparate ages. And even under the agreement, the older children were going to be spending most of their time with your client and the younger children spending most of their time with the mom. And the parties agreed to set up that arrangement and to call it joint physical custody under the agreement. So do you agree that the fact that the children are, in fact, depending on which child we're talking about, spending much more time with one parent than the other wouldn't warrant a modification to now say it's primary custody rather than joint custody? What's your view on that?
I agree with you. But there was a change in circumstances in this case.
Explain what that change is and why the judge abused her discretion in finding otherwise.
Exactly. At the time the parties entered into this agreement, that's what they contracted to do, obviously. There were to be steps taken by the mother to have more time with the older children by engaging in counseling and repairing her relationship. We had some very young children who needed time with their mother more than dad, so to speak, and that time was to increase. Dad followed the custodial arrangement, but mom completely deviated from it. And over time, there was a de facto change. So the district court failed to recognize that there was a de facto change and instead imposed on the parties this fiction that this is what they were doing. Circumstances had changed such that this is not what they were doing. Mom was not increasing her time with the older children and not engaging in counseling. And dad eventually was not seeing the little children as much, and they were staying more with mom. So it's a fiction that the court upheld, and that's abuse of discretion.
How much of a difference does there need to be from what they agreed to warrant a modification?
Again, there needs to be a significant change in the de facto schedule, a deviation, not just co-parenting, not just, oh, on Friday night, you go to the football game, instead I'll take the younger children, or on this weekend, you take the children, I'll trade off. Making accommodations is co-parenting, and that is what is expected from parents. But when they completely deviate from a written schedule in a written contract, that is a change in circumstances. It requires a relook.
So is your position that the two parties agreed to those changes or that they didn't agree to those changes?
It is Mr. Romano's position that the parties did agree. And if the court looks at the respondent's opposition at pages 6 through 7, she, in fact, asks for primary custody of the youngest children and does not dispute that the parties deviated greatly from their schedule.
Okay. Why don't you address briefly the child support issue and what change in circumstance would justify a change there?
Thank you, I will. The district court actually abused its discretion by finding that the respondent's gross monthly income had not increased by 20% or more to warrant a review of the child support obligation. Now, child support was calculated based on the respondent having zero income, but there was also the change in custody, which is really the key factor to reviewing child support. The other deviation was that the court abused its discretion by not finding there was a change in circumstances under the Burton v. Burton case. We know that this court ruled in Burton v. Burton that when new laws are enacted, parties can file a motion to modify to take advantage of new laws. However, the Child Support Commission also didn't want the floodgates to open and allow all of these motions to modify child support to be filed. Conversely, there's an equal protection issue. What about the people who got divorced a week or a month before the NAC 425 was enacted and those who got divorced after? Do the people who were divorced before have to wait 3 years for a change in circumstances to get a review of their child support? I mean, it seems to me that the court either has to overrule Burton v. Burton or make a policy change that, in accordance with the change of law, people can avail themselves under the Equal Protection Clause.
Well, here, if we have the, as you noted, the statute authorizing the enactment of regulations and the regulations that specifically say this won't constitute a change in circumstances. That was not present in Burton, correct?
Actually, the history of Burton was that Nevada law did not allow the division of property, but when the federal law changed, then the legislature of Nevada changed the law. So I understand your distinction. I still think that the Burton holding is more general and at least needs to be revisited and clarified.
You want to reserve any time?
Yes, I will. I'll reserve time unless you want to hear about the attorney's fees issue. I don't know what my time is at this point, but I do want to mention that the district court erroneously concluded there was no significant change in circumstances and penalized my client under EDCR 7.60 for seeking to have recognized the correct custodial label and what was in the best interest of his children. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Hughes, there was some fairly extensive questioning. I'll add 1 minute to your rebuttal time. You'll have 2:28, and we'll add a minute to Ms. Mastel's argument time. Go ahead, Ms. Mastel.
Thank you. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, Rachel Mastel, appearing for the respondent, Tracy Romano. May it please the court. This case started with a simple premise, a motion to redefine the custody label of a timeshare without any real change in circumstances, as this court has already, I think, kind of gotten the understanding of, unsurprisingly coupled with a motion to modify child support. And to use the law to deny Tracy the benefit of the bargain she made based on Mr. Romano's understanding of that law. But as this court has identified, it has also highlighted an issue of confusion within the law, and the court's decision will have far-reaching consequences for not only this case, but many other cases and families. At the end of the day, the family court is a court of equity. In making equitable decisions, the family court is directed to review the specific facts of a given case, look to see how they relate to the factors set forth by the legislature in the existing case law, and make the best and fairest decision for a family. When it comes to custody, the best and fairest decision is fundamentally a balancing test between the children's needs and the fundamental rights of the parents. Although the best interest of the children is the paramount consideration of the court, the decisions parents make for their children, especially those made by agreement, are given deference. This court has given great weight to agreements made by the parties. In this case, Aaron and Tracy spent several years working with their counsel to come up with an agreement that works best for their family. Given the complexity of their family situation, they chose to call that agreement joint physical custody. They clearly felt that was what best reflected their agreement, especially when given the clear statements that they would be flexible with the application of the timeshare interspersed throughout that agreement. To be clear, the parenting agreement was signed several months before the marital settlement agreement, which was the document that addressed child support, alimony, and property. At the time the parties decided their timeshare and the label, it is clear no one was trying to avoid a child support obligation. Frankly, given the disparity in the party's income, even if Tracy's alimony and passive interest were specifically calculated, it is unlikely Aaron's child support would have been any lower under the then existing statutes. This court has also long held that child support and custody should be kept as separate as possible. Unfortunately, however, child support and custody cannot be fully separated because the label put on a timeshare controls the formula by which child support is calculated. While chronology of the case makes it clear, that was not what controlled Aaron and Tracy's motivations in originally making their agreement as to custody, it clearly did control Aaron's motivations in filing the motion that is the issue of this appeal, as Judge Burton clearly knew and clearly made findings to state. Further, it cannot be ignored that the selection of a specific label could be a means of avoiding a child support obligation, at least temporarily. But agreements are not made in a vacuum, and the intentions and reasons for the parties' agreements are important. Allowing parties the benefit of the bargain made is important. Parties in making agreements are generally looking out for what's best for their families. That includes what's best for their children. Although specific provisions in an agreement may seem unrelated, even those agreements as to who receives certain property or how much alimony or child support is agreed upon are often made with a view towards the impact on the children. It cannot be said that the explicit custody arrangements, therefore, are the only piece of the puzzle viewed for its impact on children, especially when parties settle a case. The intentions of the parties and the compromises they make when settling their cases, even those not directly related to custody, are part and parcel of a give and take, presumptively made with the children's best interests in mind. As such, reasons for the parties' agreements, including the reasons parties may have given a certain label to a certain timeshare, are as many and varied as the families who settle their cases. Unfortunately, however, For many families, even a settlement isn't the end of the court's involvement in their lives, and often both custody and child support need to be modified at a later time. And that leads to the ultimate question in this case. What happens then? As this court has identified, the interaction of the case law and custody modifications, especially with regard to joint physical custody, is not clear, particularly as it relates to Mosley, Truax, and Rivero. Furthermore, the rationales for cases such as Rooney, McMonigal, Castle versus Simmons, Nance versus Ferraro, and Mizrahi also have to be considered in that framework. Although the issue is not necessarily a matter of conflicting law, the evolution of custody law in the state has created a situation where clarification is needed. The case law in Nevada supports the fact that a change in circumstances is absolutely necessary to modify custody. Mosley affirmed that fact 3 years after Truax was decided, and the court's decision in Rooney, which was decided before Truax, implies the same as well. The threshold question for a district court is, was there a change in circumstances? The remaining questions, therefore, are what constitutes a modification versus a clarification, and second, what is the burden that applies? With regard to a modification versus a clarification, a modification requires a substantial alteration of a parent's rights. Not every alteration is substantial. As in Mizrahi, determining what Jewish holidays the parties intended to include in their timeshare had an impact on the time that each party received. But that potential alteration was insufficient to be a modification.
Ms. Mastel, why wouldn't deprivation of visitation with the three younger children be a change in circumstances if that fact were true?
If that fact were true, Justice, that absolutely would be a change in circumstances. However, there was no deprivation in this case. Mr. Romano's motion made clear that he simply wasn't exercising that time. In fact, arguably, the only possible deprivation came from the idea that Mr. Romano wasn't fostering my client's relationship with the older children. However, the reality is this case is very different and very specific than a lot of other cases would be. The problems that existed, the ages of the children, existed at the time that the parties came up with a very comprehensive, very specific, highly complex parenting agreement. And that parenting agreement made it clear that they didn't intend to rigidly follow that timeshare, that they intended this to be a framework by which they would operate and build not just towards joint physical custody, but based on the children's needs. And because
I have a question though. What if one parent alleges that there's a complete deprivation and an affidavit and something like this, the other one says, well, that's untrue. Doesn't the district court have to do more than perhaps what happened here as far as if there are conflicting statements? Just to even get to that initial determination of whether or not there has been a change from the settlement agreement?
I don't believe so, because this court has long since upheld the Rooney case, which requires an adequate standard. Under that case, the district court is allowed to make decisions based off of the affidavits and offers of proof. When the Court of Appeals then added to the framework for custody, Nance versus Ferraro, they noted that courts are allowed to look back at prior decisions and prior evidence to determine if there was any kind of change in circumstances that merited this. This court has also found in Grosjean that the credibility determinations on affidavits and on testimony are the province of the district court. I believe this court very clearly stated she recalled the case. She had read the motion, she had read the opposition, she had seen the affidavits, she had reviewed the record, and that in this specific case, these details did not add up to a change in circumstances based on the facts that were before her and the facts that had been before her previously. This motion was only put forth 11 months after the custody agreement was reached and around 6 months after the marital settlement agreement was done. This case was fresh in the court's mind. She made the credibility determinations. She reviewed the record under Nance versus
this Ferraro. Was fresh in the court's mind. This wasn't agreed upon. This judge hadn't seen anything before with this case, right?
She had, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
I apologize. She had, Your Honor. This case had had 3 years of litigation before that parenting agreement was made, and there were 3 months between the parenting agreement and the marital settlement agreement, both of which were put on the record. So this judge had been actively involved in a number of discussions as to these parties' lives long before that marital settlement agreement and that parenting agreement were made.
But Nance has to do with domestic violence and knowing what happened before an order's made by a court. What I had asked, my question was, if the parties made an agreement, okay, and then later on there's a dispute as to whether or not that agreement's being followed as far as the timeshare, and it's just in affidavits, you're saying then the district court can just determine based on the affidavits and additionally offers of proof as to what the true hours are, the actual timeshare, just based on that?
Well, I think the district court was intended to have broad discretion under Rooney to make those determinations based on credibility and the offers of proof. However, I don't think that's also the facts of this case, because the reality is that even if under Rooney, even if Mr. Romano was right, that's the question, is if he was right, does this merit a change in circumstances? And because of the language of the parties' agreements, and frankly, the changes he was alleging had occurred in his motion, which my client did not necessarily entirely agree with, and she stated in her opposition she did not agree with. But even if all of those things were true, it had not been a substantial enough alteration to be a substantial alteration of their rights under the agreement that they had made. And so it didn't support adequate cause of a change in circumstance. Not every change, I don't believe this court intends to be sufficient of warranting an evidentiary hearing.
Well, I guess let me ask it one more. Let's not look at this case. Hypothetically saying, if one parent comes in after an agreement, and one parent is saying in an affidavit that there's, you know, the other parent is not or is seeing the child, and the one parent is saying, I'm never seeing the child, does the district court just make that determination without more?
I understand. I'm trying hard to answer this as well as possible. I think the answer in that question is it depends on the case. It depends on what the court knows of the party's credibility. It depends on what's in the affidavits, and it depends on what the offers of proof are. Certainly, there are absolutely cases where that allegation and those competing allegations merit an evidentiary hearing. But I don't think that's true of every case.
I have a basic question, and when you're a colleague said there were changed circumstances here. She alluded really to a non-performance of a contemplated change at the time the agreement was made. So looking at increased involvement in the children's lives as the parties evolved forward, were there other changes besides that allegation of falling short of the contemplated changes they were to make of changed circumstances in this case?
No, there were not. Mr. Romano's motion rested on the idea that it had been 11 months and they hadn't moved forward.
Okay, but if you were to measure changed circumstances with respect to the status quo as of the moment of the custody agreement, and then you say this is what they were doing that day and the week before it or the months before it, and then you go forward 11 months to the time of the motion, had anything changed?
Not according allegedly. Allegedly, yes. Allegedly, Mr. Romano was indicating that he was doing even less with the younger children than was expected in the agreement, and that my client was doing less with the older children than the agreement had contemplated. I think my client did agree that he was exercising less time with the younger children, but she didn't have an objection to that continuing to be called joint custody. As far as the older children, she did object to the characterization of what her time was like with the older children. But also, it should be noted that the older children all had teenage discretion in some fashion. So again, with the amount of flexibility the parties built into their agreement in many places, including the teenage discretion, it's hard to say, well, we were hoping to get here, but since we only got here, that's a change in circumstances. Because clearly, especially with the older children, they never intended it to be a rigid agreement that followed a certain number of days. You can't have teenage discretion and, you know, claim that's in conflict with a set provision.
Ms. Mastel, this is Justice Hardesty. I'd like to ask a question from your beginning argument. My understanding, if I heard you correctly, is that this case was important and would affect other cases in the system. Given the fact intensity of this arrangement, I'm not sure how. Could you please expand on that? What are the issues that you see warrants some determination by this court that would influence or affect other pending cases?
I think the court's questions for supplemental briefing are those things that impact and influence other cases going forward.
Could you address some of those questions, particularly the Rodriguez question?
Absolutely, Your Honor. You know, when it comes to, I think the big question this court had on Rivero is, you know, what is a modification, and is a modification of the label the modification itself? And the answer to that is it can be, but it's not necessarily, because if you have an ambiguity between a label and a timeshare, you have an ambiguity, you have a clarification issue, and that's why the party's intentions and maybe even parole evidence matter so much, because you have to look and see what the parties meant. The additional issue, and I know I don't have time to really get to it, is the consideration of Rooney and the, you know, what discretion the court has in setting those evidentiary hearings, as well as, you know, where the changed circumstances applies when dealing with joint custody and how that may or may not change the burden for modification in a joint custody case.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mastel. Ms. Hughes?
Thank you, Justices. Very briefly, I want to hit on the points that you asked in your questions. There was a complete deviation from the contracted schedule. Mother was to have time with the two older children. She had zero time for nearly a year. The third to the oldest child was spending some time with her after school, and after a period of time, he spent zero time with her. And this is borne out in the opposition. It's not supported by the record that there was not a complete deviation. That is factually incorrect. There was a complete deviation that was admitted by the mother and conceded by the mother. And to answer your question about whether or not the parties are in disagreement, then the court simply makes the comparison. What are they doing now, and what's the custodial order? It doesn't open the door to let parole evidence in. These parties completely abandoned the agreement. And the court should look at the current situation as of the time they see the parties. And that was 11 months later.
So one of my concerns, Ms. Hughes, is this, and maybe I'm looking at this incorrectly, but parents change arrangements all the time just as a matter of cooperation. Does this mean then that every time the parents decide to shift gears from the agreed upon agreement, that we're going to be calling back all these folks into the family court for revisiting these issues?
Absolutely not. And that was the point I tried to make and perhaps did not emphasize enough in my opening statement, that parents are expected to co-parent. And if there is a slight change, it doesn't necessarily mean a substantial change in circumstances. But when there's a complete deviation, that in effect goes against the agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Hughes, in this case, given that the parties contemplated that they were establishing an agreement, the agreement itself talked about flexibility and talked about making efforts to work toward more time with the other parent, is 11 months later saying, see, that didn't happen, a change in circumstance, or how long would they have to work toward that? How do we judge that as a court? And Chief, can she answer that?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Well, the court set forth the 12-month period under Rivero, and that's the standard by which the district court was looking at this. And if I may just briefly talk about teenage discretion, that agreement never allowed the teenagers to change their custodial status. That agreement allowing teenage discretion was simply that, that maybe if I don't want to go over there tonight and I've got a baseball game to go to, I can go do that. But the teenagers were not in charge of their custodial status. And the look-back period is set forth in Rivero.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Hughes, Ms. Mastel, for your arguments and briefing in this case. The case will stand submitted and the court will be in recess. Thank you.